So as we're looking at the book of Haggai, we want to continue with a little background. We got us up to the time of the restoration in our overview last week. And we closed the class with a discussion of the 70 weeks of Daniel. And I want to revisit that just a little bit and then go on and look at Ezra chapters 4 and 5 so we can understand exactly what was happening in the opening of Haggai chapter 1. Haggai, more than any prophet in the Old Testament, dates his speeches or his exhortations very specifically the day of the king, the month, and the day of the month in which he prophesied. I believe he's following the Hebrew calendar there in Haggai. But he is recognizing the year of the reign of Darius or Darius, who is Darius Hystaspes or Darius the First, who was known as the Great, the fourth king of the Persian Empire, who came to power through either a military coup or a restoration of the line of kings, at least the family of kings who had been reigning in Persia. It's not exactly known what happened. That third king who is mentioned in Ezra is generally thought to have been Smerdis or Gautama. Others have given him another name, and they actually believe he was, some believe he was a legitimate heir, but either he was assassinated and someone took his place pretending to be him, or, and then when Darius came to the throne, they assassinated the imposter, or some think that Darius assassinated the legitimate heir and just told everybody he was an imposter. So there's no way for knowing for sure other than to say this, that Darius was not a direct descendant of Cyrus or Cambyses. And then the line ends and Darius becomes king. He is undoubtedly the best king of that empire. And it is he who extended it from India all the way to the Mediterranean. And it is his son, Xerxes the First, who is the king in the book of Esther. And it is he who pursues wars with Greece but is not successful. So anyway, this is the this is where we are as far as the history is concerned. So we're running along in there in those years around 536 BC when the children of Israel come back to Palestine. And that's really what I was talking about when we were talking about the 70 weeks. That vision of Daniel is broken down basically into three parts there in Daniel chapter 9. There is the first section of 7 weeks. Then there's the middle section of 62 weeks. And then there's the last section of 1 week, which is the 70th week. That first section, the 7 weeks, commences with Cyrus' decree that is mentioned there in Ezra chapter 1, as well as 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 21 through 23. Daniel had said there in the beginning of chapter 9 that he had been able to learn from the book of Jeremiah the number of years that were determined for the desolations of Jerusalem, which in Jeremiah 25, verses 9 through 11, Jeremiah says was 70 years. So Daniel had access to the book of Jeremiah. And let's just let me say this there. That's just a proof of the fact that these books were written and they were circulated and that they were read even among the Jews. I sometimes hear things about how illiterate people were in ancient times and how hard it was to have copies of books and so on and so forth. Well, all of that may be true to some extent. But the reality is that these books were written with the intention to be read, and they were to be read to the people. And the Jews regularly came up to Jerusalem prior to the captivity. And then these prophets were sent to them in the places of their captivity. And so these prophets preached, and these prophets were read. And those among the people who were literate, as was Daniel, obviously, they were studied and understood. So this idea that nobody knew what God was doing or that everybody was just ignorant in ancient times is for the birds. The Jews knew just exactly what God's plan was. You can't open the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and not be impressed with the fact that the people knew their scriptures and that they were looking for the Messiah, and that they understood the prophets had predicted these things, and to argue that nobody knew anything is ridiculous. The Jews were probably among the most literate people of ancient times. And the fact that a people may have a high illiteracy rate, that is people who can't read, doesn't mean they're all ignorant, and doesn't mean they can't understand plain Hebrew when it's spoken to them. And so these folks knew their scriptures. Plus, in ancient times, because of this difficulty of accessing books and so on and so forth, a lot of people just memorized scripture, memorized what was being said. And we don't rely as much on memory anymore as we used to. Mine's not what it used to be, and I sometimes think that the telephone's part of the problem, because I haven't remembered a telephone number in 15, 20 years nearly. And it's just stuff that I don't bother to remember anymore because I have a way of retrieving that information. But we need to realize that the Jews knew what was going on, and here's Daniel now telling them what's going to happen. And so the decree goes forth, and this is the decree of which Isaiah speaks in Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 28, where Isaiah specifically names Cyrus as the servant of the Lord who would give the commandment to rebuild and restore Jerusalem. All right? So see all these prophecies falling into place. You have Isaiah prophesying 700 years before Christ, 700 years before Christ, another 100 years before Cyrus. So 100 years before Cyrus, that he would be the one who would rebuild Jerusalem. So before it's even destroyed, God is announcing who's going to rebuild it. See, this is the power of prophecy. And this is what I'm wanting you to see, is the idols couldn't do this. The diviners and the prognosticators and the prophets of these idols, they couldn't predict the future like this. The Oracle of Delphi, which is perhaps the best known of the ancient oracles, even though it would not be contemporaneous with this necessarily, but those oracles, when you read some of them, if you ever read some of the literature from that time or some of the Shakespearean plays that refer to it, the oracle is always ambiguous, isn't it? It can mean one thing or it can mean something else. The Greek tragedy, Oedipus, is a perfect example of where the Oedipus understood the oracle to mean one thing, and actually it meant just the opposite, something altogether different. So they're vague, they're ambiguous. And that they're not like this. God says 70 years. Daniel says, I figured it out. God said 70 years. It's time for that to happen. Get ready. And then what happens? What God said would happen in 70 years. And so This is the proof of Jeremiah as a prophet, of Daniel as a prophet, of Isaiah as a prophet. And so there's that beginning of that 7 weeks, and that 7 weeks ends with the completion of the temple, which is what we're going to read about here just in a moment in Ezra. And that's what Haggai is prophesying about, the need to complete that temple. Now, just for your notes, the intervening 62 weeks is the history which Daniel reveals in chapters 7, 8, 10 through 12 of his book. The vision of the four beasts, and then the vision of the he-goat and the ram, and then the vision there in chapters 10 through 12 of the nations that come out of the Greek Empire. And so you have all that history laid out, and that's recorded in the book of 1 Maccabees. Now, that is not a book that's in the Bible. There was some debate about it at one point, many, many centuries ago, but the Jews never accepted the book of Maccabees as a part of their scripture, but they always recognized it as pretty good history. And Josephus quotes from it quite a bit. So 1 Maccabees is the contemporary history. And when you read 1 Maccabees, you just see the book of Daniel being fulfilled in those chapters that I just mentioned, where the rise of the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire have conflict. The Greeks replace the Persians. The Persians are dominated by the Greeks. Alexander goes all the way to India. He says there's no more world to conquer because even he wouldn't go into Afghanistan, and comes back, dies, empire divided into four pieces, which is exactly what the vision indicated in Daniel. And then you have the two predominant groups coming out of that, the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. And chapters 10 through 12 is about their conflict. And then ultimately you have the Romans coming in there at the end of Daniel and dominating the region. And that's the beginning of Daniel chapter 2. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall not be destroyed. And when the New Testament opens, you have Luke recording that it was in the days of the Roman Caesars, that John the Baptist came. So the whole history is completed there. And so with Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, you have essentially the ending of the 69th week. And so now the 70th week, which is not to be interpreted literally in any way, it's just a prophetic number that involves a 7 and a 10, completion, power, God completing his plan, obviously then. And so in the 70th week, in the middle of that week, who's cut off? The Messiah. And so with the coming of the Messiah, the 70th week begins, and the 70th week is going to end with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And that's Matthew 24, Luke 21, and the parallels in Mark. So that's your 70 weeks, you see. And these first 7 weeks, which involves this rebuilding of the temple, are essential to moving God's plan forward. And so that's what I want you to see Haggai as he is the Barnabas of his generation. He is coming to tell the Jewish people, look, we have a role to play. We have a part to fulfill, and we must do it. And God expects you to do it. And everything he says about what's going on in Palestine at that time is a reflection of that plan and purpose and of what God had already told them. He reminds them he's the God that brought them out of Egypt. He's still that same God. And so he's going all, God continually does this with the prophets. He's going all the way back to Moses, the covenant, the promise, and the fact that he says, you said you'd do what I told you to do. And here's what I'm telling you to do. And until you do it, things are not going to get better. But when Haggai gets them stirred up, and it's amazing, he gets results in 21 days. When Haggai gets them stirred up and gets them going, God says, I will bless you. All right? So, and really, that's the message of the book of Haggai. But now we want to get over here to chapters 4 and 5 of Ezra so we can get the details of what we open up with there in Haggai. So those first three chapters of Ezra, the children of Israel come back with Zerubbabel, who was the governor, a descendant of David, and I'll talk some more about him here directly, and Joshua, or Yeshua, some of the versions say, but Joshua, who was the high priest, and he had become high priest. His father, Jehozadak, had replaced his father, who had died at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar at the close of the destruction of Jerusalem. So the people come back, and they lay the foundation of the temple there in verse 8 of chapter 3. Now, the second year of their coming to the house of God. So, if they came in 538, this would be 536. All right? So, in the second year of their coming to the house of God of Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. Then stood Yeshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together to set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad, with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. And if you remember your history, David had set all of this up, the 24 courses of the priests, the singers, and all of this in the temple. And so here you have the children of Israel under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Yeshua putting things back just like they were when it was original. That's what it means to restore something. Putting it back like the original, it means to follow the pattern. So there's your teaching point this morning, that when we restore the New Testament church, what do? We follow the pattern. We put it back like it was. And so the builders laid the foundation of the temple and set the priests in their apparel, so on and so forth. Verse 11, and they sang together by course in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord, because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because of the foundation of the house of the Lord that was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and chiefs of the fathers who were ancient men. Now, ancient men would have been, they've been in the captivity for 70 years. And when you look at that list of names that come back, I mean, Mordecai's even in that list. And so, these are the Jews. Now, it may have not been the Mordecai of Esther, but nevertheless, there are some really old men here who had gone through the entire list. There's a Daniel in the list. That may have been our Daniel. I'm not sure. But they were all over 70 because they'd been in the captivity all this time. Those are the only ones who had seen the temple. The ones who were born in the captivity had never seen the temple of the Lord, you see. So the ancient men he's talking about, the chiefs of the fathers that had seen the first house when the foundation of the house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. Now, Haggai is going to reference this fact that I just read to you in his book. That's why I wanted to come back to this, because he's going to talk about, some of you didn't think that the glory of this house was like the former house. And Haggai's going to say, no, the glory of this house, even though it's smaller, even though it's built with material that's nowhere comparable to what was adorning the temple at the time of our departure, all the gold on the doors and all the magnificent vessels and ornamentation that was there. So here we've laid this foundation, and it's smaller than the original temple. Okay? And so these old men who remembered that, they wept. Said, this is not what I was expecting at all. And so you can see how here in a moment that these folks might have been eventually discouraged. Because what they had hoped and what they were expecting was not happening. Now let me tell you something. That's what we do in the church sometimes. We have great plans and we think, well, great things are going to happen. And we get us a great preacher and we get us a big building and we get us all these magnificent things. And then it doesn't turn out like we thought it would. Or perhaps the church does grow and it becomes magnificent in the eyes of the world. And then what happens? The devil gets in there and tears it up. And what happens to people? They get discouraged. They want to quit. You see. And so here we have all these people shouting and weeping. And this is a case of mixed emotions. All right? Now, when the adversaries, chapter 4 of Judah and Benjamin, heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as ye do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, which brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel and Yeshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, you have nothing to do with us to build the house of our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord the God, the king of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us. In other words, this ain't none of your business. You have no part in this. What are they? They're Gentiles. They're Samaritans. So the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building. And so here you have the enemies of God's people trying to get them to compromise with him. Let us build with you. Let us get involved in this. That is always the plea of the world. And so often brethren get caught up in that. Well, we could get all these other folks we could really get big and we could get big numbers and a lot of influence if we let these. Yes, what do you got to do to let them in? Got to compromise. That's right, Gary. You got to compromise. So we can't compromise. God told us to build it. We can't let you do it. We cannot compromise on this point. So then they started hiring lawyers and counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So from 536 all the way up until about 520, they got to put up with this. All right? And so they start writing letters. Verse 6, they wrote a letter during the reign of Ahasuerus in the beginning of his reign, and that's Cambyses. And it looks like that didn't have much effect because Cambyses was too busy carrying out his campaigns against his enemies on the frontier of the West, going down into Egypt. And plus he didn't live very long after this. And so then in the days of Artaxerxes wrote, and Artaxerxes, he took an interest in this. And this Artaxerxes is this Smyrtus, Gautama, whichever one. And he comes along, and this is why I think that the assassination theory doesn't work very well. If this guy were an imposter, what's the last thing he wants? He doesn't want any trouble out on the frontier. And so he says, well, just stop those fellas. And that's really what that whole chapter four there is about. They wrote the letter, said these folks, these Jews are troublemakers. They've never been anything but troublemakers. And that's why the Assyrians and the Babylonians came against them. That's why they destroyed this temple. And if you let them build this temple and you let them build this city, they're going to be trouble for you. And so Artaxerxes says, stop. And so there the work ceased, verse 24, on the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So Darius comes on the scene. He gets rid of Smyrdis. He solidifies the kingdom. And then these troublemakers for the Jews write him a letter. And here's a fellow who knows what needs to be done. And he will do it. But in the meantime, you have a meanwhile back on the ranch section there, chapter 5, verse 1, which is where our book Haggai opens. Then the prophets Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God, of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. So you've got Haggai and Zechariah out there saying, look, we got to build, we got to build. You are not doing what God wants us to do. They're very well aware of the timeline. And so they're urging the people to finish the work. And so just as soon as it was observed that these Jews were back at work, like I said, it took 3 weeks to get them stirred up, which is really pretty good preaching if you ask me. And he gets them stirred up and they're ready to go. And so at that same time came to them Tatnai, governor on this side of the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions, and said thus unto them, who hath commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? Then said he unto them, after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius, and when they returned an answer by a letter concerning this matter. And so the Jews said, well, we're not stopping until we get a ruling from the king. And so the prophets are the ones that are urging them on. It says, God is with you. God will bless you. And so what do they say? We don't care what you want. We're not stopping. And so then you have there in chapter 5, the letter that goes to Darius. And so he says, well, let's find out what is in the archives. And what did we learn from the book of Daniel about the kings of the Persians? Remember when Darius put Daniel in the lion's den after they tricked him into doing it. And he said, the law of the Medes and the Persians, what? Cannot be changed. Now, do you see God's hands in this? What kingdom does he put in power at the time that the temple has to be rebuilt? He puts the Persians in power. And what's true of their law? It can't be changed. And Cyrus is my servant, and he's the first king, and he said, this is what will be done. Okay? Now notice what happens. So, thus they returned to answer, verse 11, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house which was builded many years ago, which a great king of Israel builded and set up. But after that our fathers had provoked God of heaven. So they give the whole history of how evil that they had been. And then it says in verse 14 that those vessels did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto us, whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. That's a reference to Zerubbabel. and said unto him, take these vessels, go to Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. And then came Sheshbazzar, or Zerubbabel, and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even until now, hath it been in building, and yet it is not finished. Now therefore, if it seem good to the king, let there be a search made in the king's treasure house, which is there at Babylon, whether it be so that a decree was made by Cyrus, the king, to build this house of the God of Israel, and let the king send his pleasure to us concerning this matter. And so Darius does that. Verse 1 of chapter 6, and there was found, verse 2, at Akmetha in the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, and there was a record written. In the first year of Cyrus, the king of the same Cyrus, the king, made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be builded, the place where they offer sacrifices, and let the foundation thereof be strongly laid, the height thereof 3 score cubits, the breadth thereof 3 score cubits, with 3 rows of great stones and a row of new timber, and let the expenses be given out of the king's house. And so let the gold and the silver vessels, and so on and so forth. Now therefore, verse 6, Tatnai, governor beyond the river, Shetharboznai, and your companions, the Arphaxites, I didn't practice my names this morning, which are beyond the river, be ye far from thence. In other words, don't bug these people. Let the work of the house of God alone, let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. Moreover, I make a decree that ye shall do to the elders of these Jews for the building of the house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river. Therefore, expenses be given unto these men that they be not hindered. And so Cyrus just busted their budget. Says, you're going to pay for this. And that which they have need of, both bullocks and rams and lambs and burnt offerings for the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given to them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet savors unto the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and of his sons. Also, I have made a decree that whatsoever shall alter this word, let the timber be pulled down from his house, and being set up, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this. And the God that hath caused this name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people that shall put to their hand to alter, to destroy this house of God, which is at Jerusalem. I, Darius, have made a decree, let it be done with speed. Done. So, Haggai is the prophet who's responsible for getting the people to do this and causing them not to fear the people of the land, nor to fear the king of Persia. And now here the hand of God is in all of this. And the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be changed, is not changed. And furthermore, another king comes along, he says, and if anybody tries to change it, we're going to pull his house down, we're going to take the timbers thereof, we're going to build a gallows, and we are going to hang him on it. And then we'll take it and him and everything he had and make a heap out of it. And it'll become a dung pile. That's pretty final, isn't it? Now, folks, that's the God we serve. That's the God we serve. So verse 13 says that the governor and all his companions did that which Darius the king had sent, so they did speedily. And the elders of the Jews builded, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, and they builded and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. And so we jump forward about 4 years. All right. So that's where we are. One other thing I wanted to do this morning that will help us understand something that's going to come up. I mentioned Zerubbabel last week and the fact that he's in the lineage of Jesus, both on Mary's side and on Joseph's side. Matthew chapter 1, verse 12. Luke chapter 3, I'll have to look. 34, I think, but I'm not going to swear to that. No. Let's see. 27. 34 gets us back to Abraham. Okay, so you have there in verse 27, which was the son of Joanna, which was the son of Resa, which was the son of Zerubbabel, which was the son of Shealtiel, which was the son of Neri. And one of the things that happens, or that gets brought up in connection to, with this, is that, well, it's kind of difficult to explain how in the world Zerubbabel can be the son of Shealtiel when there's discrepancy in the names in those two lists. And it's not just a discrepancy of one name or two names, it goes on back. There's also the problem that in Matthew's list, there are some names that are omitted for the purpose of the literary device which he is using, 14, 14, and 14, which is probably a memory device for the purpose of emphasizing the captivity and the fact, and Jeconiah gets counted twice there in that. And the reason for that is, as I say, the emphasis in Matthew's list is on that this came out of the captivity. And in light of what we've just studied, you can see why to Jews, that's the audience that Matthew primarily has, that the emphasis on the captivity and God fulfilling the promise with regard to Messiah and Zerubbabel being the signet on God's right hand. And that's how the book of Haggai ends, that there was a special blessing coming on Zerubbabel. But these Jews would want to know how this is going to be accomplished. And so Zerubbabel is in the kingly line, and then Jesus descends from that. And so the solution to the problem is indeed Zerubbabel. And so there are several possible explanations, but I want you to look at 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 17 and 19. And this is kind of a evidences point. Now, I'm not going to say that this is the absolute solution, because there are several that are pretty good. This is the one that makes the most sense to me. And if we can take up an apparent contradiction and we can give a reasonable, rational explanation that handles all the points of concern, then you have a removal of the contradiction, right? And if a legitimate, reasonable, rational explanation can be given, then it is incumbent upon the one who raised the objection to accept it or to show that the explanation given does not resolve the apparent conflict. So in 1 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 17, the sons of Jeconiah, Asher, Salathiel his son, and that Asher there should have been translated Jeconiah the captive, and you may have a version that says that. Okay. Sylvia confirms what I'm saying back there. So Jeconiah, the captive, referring to the fact that Jeconiah surrendered to Nebuchadnezzar and he was carried into Babylon and he stayed in jail for 34 years, you remember, until Evil-Merodach released him. And then he says, Salathiel his son, Melchiram also, and Padiah, and Shenazar, Jeconiah, Hoshama, and Nedabiah. All right, so Jeconiah had several sons in captivity, didn't he? But Jeremiah had said in Jeremiah chapter 22, write this man childless. But I went over that with you in class last week, that his childlessness was not meaning that he wouldn't ever have any children, but it did mean he would never have any sons who would reign on the throne in Judah. And that's what Jeremiah specifically says there in that last verse of chapter 22. So, but notice there that he has a son whose name is Pedaiah. So verse 19, and the sons of Pedaiah were Zerubbabel and Shimei, and the sons of Zerubbabel, Meshulam and Hananiah and Shalomith, their sister, and so on and so forth. So Zerubbabel is named as the son of Pedaiah. But in the list in Matthew and in Luke and in the book of Ezra, as well as Haggai, if I'm remembering correctly, he is called the son of Shealtiel. So how is it that the son of Pedaiah can be the son of Shealtiel? And so there's our contradiction. We've got a problem here. How do we explain this? And here is the solution that I believe is the right one and reasonable. Under the law of Moses, there was a provision for levirate marriage. You remember that? Where the husband who dies without any sons, his wife, his widow, now it becomes the wife of the next heir. Okay? You see that fulfilled in the story about Judah and Tamar, Judah had three sons. God killed the first one, God killed the second one, and then the third one, who was so much younger, Shua, and Judah didn't fulfill his promise, and so Tamar, she disguised herself, sat by the side of the road, seduced Judah as a harlot, because he was a widower at that point, seduced him as a harlot, and she went in unto her, and she conceived, and so the lineage of the line of Judah continues through Perez, who was one of the twins that was born to Judah and Tamar. So, that's where the provision of levirate marriage is first observed. And Boaz also is an example of that when he marries Ruth, who was the widow of the daughters of the son of Naomi, who had died while they were in Moab. And so her child becomes also in the lineage of Christ, because Salmon begat Boaz, Boaz begat Obed, so forth, and Obed begat Jesse. And Jesse begat David the king, and that's the end of the book of Ruth. And so there's this principle of levirate marriage, and levirate marriage had been observed. You see, this is the reason why Ruth's in there. Levirate marriage has been observed as a means for establishing the direct lineage. And so when Zerubbabel is called the son of Shealtiel, when Chronicles lists him as the son of Pedaiah, it seems to me, even though we do not have a direct statement, well, I say this is one solution. It seems to me that the best, easiest, most consistent with the teaching of Scripture is that he became the heir. Shealtiel didn't have any sons because he's not listed as having any sons. So Shealtiel died without sons, and Pedaiah then fulfilled the role of levirate marriage, and Zerubbabel is counted as the heir of Shealtiel. Now, there are others that involve textual criticism and the misplacing of names and all that, and I stay as far away from those kinds of explanations because I don't believe God's the author of confusion. And so while it may be difficult, it is consistent.